Oh, good morning. It is technically still morning, although we've been up for some time at this point. I hope the I hope your sitting practice is going well, not too painful or too uncomfortable. And of course, as for many of you who are new, perhaps it's your first time here, then it's a little bit of an adjustment necessary with the with the forms, the way that we do things. I caught myself there where I said, you know, we can move around, you can be quite informal. Well, considering the way I'm dressed, probably not quite so informal, right? So, but we have these forms for good reason. This beginner's mind session at Yokoji Zen Center. So where you're practicing within the sphere of a Soto Zen tradition with elements, so a lot of Rinzai Zen tradition mixed in there too. Yokoji itself is a Soto lineage Zen Buddhist temple, but the founder Maizumi Roshi, who came to the United States from Japan, carried a couple of different Soto lineages and a lineage of a lay Rinzai lineage with him too. Why do I bring that up? It's because this is something of a hybrid practice of Zen Buddhist styles here, which was inherited from Japan, which previously had come from China, which previously had come from India, and so, but a long tradition that tracks its origin story back to the personage represented on the altar, Shakyamuni Buddha. So Zen is a school of Mahayana Buddhism. When we read back and look back to what's known about the historical Buddha, I'd refresh myself now and again and see, because there's modern scholarship and people are always maybe unearthing new things about histories which we may have taken more for granted in the past, and that changes over time. Although I read earlier that the scholarship has pretty much given up on the historical personage of the Buddha, of clearly defining when exactly he lived, who exactly was, what exactly was going on at that time. There's a lot of overlap. They're not quite sure of which year, which happened then. But we do know that that person existed and taught in India at that time. So the Buddha was, of course, an extraordinary teacher. This is, of course, pre-science, ancient world. And yet he was able to look into the fact of the human experience, what it is to be a human being, and then to unpack that, right, and see how that corresponds and aligns with this curious reality that we're all involved in, that we've been involved in for all of these decades that we've been alive. It is, you know, sometimes we take it for granted, or that mystery gets covered up with, mundanity, like everyday life, or it seems pretty, okay, like another normal day. And yet when we really look at it, to appear in the world, in this reality as a human being here now, is an unfathomable mystery. So we're all very much involved in exploring that. You know, from the Buddha's teaching and his example, that teaching, of course, has spread far and wide throughout the world. Right. And here, this is the living representation of that transmission of Buddhism moving through, again, India, China, Japan quite recently, and then into the United States. So we're now involved in a slow, organic change as it becomes a little more Americanized for for good and for bad, right? It's like we'll see how things adjust from one culture to another. Typically in Buddhism, that's a process that takes a couple of hundred years or something. But it does seem that everything's speeding up, and things that took a couple of hundred years tend to happen faster. So even in my experience of being here, this would be like 20 years, I think. Then there's been changes in the way that we do things. And perhaps a simplifying of some of the forms, which I'm talking about. Some of the amount of chants, the bows, how to do each and everything that we do. But we're very slow to make changes. As I like to bring up, and those people that live here have to forgive me bringing it up again, but it was a good lesson for me. It's when I first moved here to practice Zen, after about 2 weeks of living here, I knew the changes that needed to be made around the place. This is silly, this isn't working, this is, etc., etc. As human beings, we're very wired with that judgment sense. It's always navigating, reality, seeing what works, what doesn't, and our opinion that, right? And then often expressing our opinion about that. I was quickly disavowed of that, living at a Zen center, fortunately, after a couple of weeks. And then after about 10 years, much more I had the sense of wanting to protect what we were doing and not change anything at all. Because I'd come to understand through experience that all of the forms, everything that we do, has a very practical reason for doing so. And that practical reason is rooted in a beneficial action to help us focus attention and return to what is most vital and what is present, to disrupt the individuated self-preference, which we're all, I think we're all running that in the background, are we not? Sometimes in the foreground, right? So these forms are slow to change for that reason. When we come to a retreat like this, you plug into a container of concentrated practice. Right, it's a collective endeavor that we create a container, like in the meditation hall. It's wonderful to see the meditation hall very, very full. It's pretty much every seat's taken. And just before the retreat, we were thinking, well, we might have a few extra people under our seats. And it was like, we'll work it out. Let's see how it is. Usually it's a couple of people come down with a cold or something else just before. I can't make it for one reason or another. And this one, I think we kind of hit the sweet spot. So much so that as we come in here for the talk, it's like the last couple of people are like, okay, where am I going to sit? Right? We just fill it nicely. And with that, we create a container in order to practice. But to practice what? I look around and I know many people here over some years, so I know something of your attention, intention, and your practice, and the why of why you show up. But then for others who were seeing you for the first time, then that's still a blank page, wondering what brings you here. I can make a guess. Right, I think there's some interest in, of course, in meditation, perhaps in Zen distinctly, perhaps in wishing to disconnect from the chaos and busyness of everyday life, work, responsibilities, everything that goes into this modern life, and dang it, just get up to the mountains for a couple of days. That might be enough to just... To step out of the world and come to a place where the lifestyle does foster a peaceful mind and helps to develop concentration. So maybe perhaps you fall into those kind of broad categories, or you have something unique. But what is it that we're doing here through our weekend. I mentioned in the guidelines yesterday evening, you know, you get that the orientation is 100 things to remember, and, you know, it's okay, and then kind of dive in with a sort of not knowing what you're doing approach. So I commend you for doing that. And then we have the hours of meditation, the sitting time, and that's really the heart of our practice this weekend, and the heart of our practice on a day-to-day basis here, whatever is the schedule. Zazen, or sitting meditation in the Zen tradition, is our firm foundation for life and for the way of Dharma. And with that, then, no matter the cultural differences or what's changed over the many centuries, then we share that common heritage and connection with the historical Buddha, you know, who all those centuries ago sat under the Bodhi tree, the shade, after long years of practice and austerities, of learning method and inquiring into life. Finally, it just brought him to sitting down on the ground, not moving, looking directly at this experience of being a human being. We all have that in common in this practice of sitting. Now, you may have already learned and put to good use a concentration, a practice method. Right, there are several within the tradition of Zen meditation. Typically, we all spend some time developing a serviceable posture, just a way to sit. You know, body's sometimes a little uncooperative with that, and it changes over the years, you know. Over the years that I've practiced, I've had brief times where sitting was just, you know, it's just right. Very brief windows where that occurs. Very brief times, you know. And then other times where it's just like, it's like, you know, very difficult with just discomfort and sometimes pain. But we find a posture, we find a way to sit down, and then we bring in some method. Typically in our Zen school, we have our breath awareness practices. Either counting the breath, or following the breath. A very ancient way that people, you know, practice for many generations, long before the Buddha. Right? There's a very positive shift that happens in sitting down, being still, and moving attention toward the physical movement of breath. Just to be, if you practice in that way, if you just sit down and give some time each day towards being still, quiet, and focusing on your breath, then you'll be well served by that practice. But as we know, in our 30-minute sitting periods, not so easy to just sit and become immersed in breath awareness as a living Buddha, and express your enlightenment throughout the 10 directions. Usually it doesn't fall in your lap Friday evening, that experience. But, you know, if it did, hands up, let's, you know, identify yourself. Well, yeah. But for most of us, that's just the beginning practice. Being able to just sit down and be still and to try and realize present mind. What gets in the way? Typically, thinking mind and the identity of me-self. Ah, right? So, as we're all familiar with. After all, it was me, you, I had decided to come on retreat. Me, you, I that ran the card in the office or sent in a check, right? We live with this enigma of me, I, self. Right? We have a name, a history, relationships and family and connections, right? So that's beyond a doubt. But the Buddha, and many since and before the Buddha, have uncovered the truth that when we look into this I-me, it's very difficult to say what that actually is. who that actually is, the I, me. Right? The basic teachings of Buddha and other teachers in many other different modalities have looked into this. Like Zen is a direct approach of, and Buddhism is a direct approach of, find out for yourself. Look, you do the work, right? We got some nice buildings, we've got the mountains, everything set up, we've got some cushions, but you come in and you sit down and you look for yourself. You look for yourself at what is this life that I am? What is the nature of this reality that I am? What is the nature of this reality experience? Now, I wanted to bring in a few words from some generations after the Buddha, just saying that that tradition came from India into China, many different countries, but this temple, this lineage goes through Japan, China, India. If we go back to the beginnings of Zen in early China, we look back to something that's commonly called a golden age of Zen. That sounds good. The golden the golden age of Zen, which is kind of like early like Tang Dynasty China, 8th century, that kind of era. This is when the teachings of Buddhism from India had become infused and integrated into the Chinese systems or understandings of Taoism and Confucianism, and it started taking on a unique what would become known as Chan Zen. Well, Zen is just a Japanese pronunciation of the Chinese characters for Chan, which in turn means dhyana or meditation in India. So we come to this time in China where something uniquely Zen begins to emerge. Buddhism has many, of course, perhaps hundreds of different lineages, approaches. So they're very much culturally integrated with the countries from which they've emerged and their practice. It's often hard to see where the culture begins and strictly the spiritual practice begins and how those are entangled, right? And Zen, emerging out of China during this time, produced a wealth of teachings, of writings, of which we use here today. So when we came in for service this morning, you came in and you're like, oh my gosh, what's going on now? All right, I got a book and like a chant and some stuff. And this is me projecting sometimes that's what I think, It's like, what are we doing here? And so we're chanting these words from many centuries ago, which are describing reality, of our inquiry and understanding of the reality. And reality hasn't changed in those couple of thousand years. People have changed in terms of content and, we've got iPhones now. But in terms of arms, legs, eyes and ears and needing to eat and go to sleep, nothing as much has changed over these millennia. But back in this rich time in China, people began to write down and comment and look at, like, how do we articulate this understanding that the Buddha realized? So in Zen, we go right, when we talk about the Buddha typically, a point to the Buddha, we're actually talking or pointing to the Buddha's realization under the Bodhi tree. The enlightenment realization of the Buddha. That's typically what we look to. Right, in an effort to realize that for ourselves, which may sound like a tall order, but the Buddha was a human being. These Zen teachers throughout time are just human beings, and we're also in the same place, and we can also share in this realization of reality, of the way of the human condition. So somewhere probably 8th century, it's credited as being much earlier, but there was it was probably created a little later. You look into that era and things can be a little shaky for dating things. But there was a writing called, which we called Faith in Mind. I think it's, how do you say it in Japanese?
Xin
Jing Ming in Japanese. Yeah, and in Chinese? Oh, there you go. That's convenient, isn't it? All right, and that's been variously translated. The popular one is a faith in mind, sometimes translated as truthful mind. You know, if you really break down the ideograms, then it could be translated as inscription on relying on mind. Inscription on relying on mind. And a student, Attention Roshi's, who's Abba here, who's in this morning, be in later, who works on translation, Jindo Butler, he translated this as trust your heart, which is another nice way to put it. So we can put it in several different ways. It's a long writing. I'm just going to bring in about four lines, right? So in the opening here, and there's various different translations. I'm just going to bring out a couple. Here's the first one. The best way, the great way, the Tao, is not difficult. It only excludes picking and choosing. Once you stop loving and hating, it will enlighten itself. Another translation of the same lines now. The perfect way knows no difficulties, except it refuses to make preferences. Only when freed from dislike and like, it reveals itself fully and without disguise. All right, and once more, and this is Jindo's translation. Concerning the way, there will be no difficulty if only you dislike being picky. Just don't be dead set against or set on anything. When you are thoroughly like this, the way is obvious. Okay? So this is our prescription for Zazen and our practice through the weekend. And maybe our practice in our life. Concerning the way. This is the way. Right? The only game in town. We're living it. Right? This is our life. We're all sharing in this. In this mystery. This is the way. So, this is where to look. Now, just saying that, this is the way, might not mean much. Well, great, thanks a lot, this is the way. You know, it's not doing much for me right now, but, you know, right? But I'm being assured that this is actually the way. It is the way, but there's a lot of difference in terms of realization of the way. Making this statement of this bringing this truth and making it real. Knowing that this now is the awakened or the enlightened way. And it took the Buddha many years. He had to practice in the forests of northern India and all these austerities and study with different teachers, eventually throw it all away, sit under a tree, become realized. For most people in the Zen tradition, then it's typically in the practice a teacher-student relationship, or dare I say it, a master-disciple relationship, using, you know, a kind of a different language set to describe it. But usually a person studies with a person over a long period of years, and that person who's teaching will have spent a long period of years studying it with their teacher. Like Tenshin Roshi, who's teaching this morning, be teaching tonight. I studied, you know, close study with him. Well, I've been here 20 years, you know. I've been about 12 years of close study and teaching for about 10 years. He, similar track for him with his teacher, Maizumi Roshi, who I mentioned, who came from Japan. So we have this kind of long apprenticeship model and study. So again, realization or making awakening real doesn't tend to just fall in our lap directly, but it might, and it can, and it sometimes does. You can take the shortcut. You can feel empowered to take the shortcut of realization and just get this done right from the start in your practice of Zazen. Just listen to our words here. Concerning the way, there will be no difficulty. If only you dislike being picky. Ah, now that tends to be a little bit of a hurdle in this practice of realization, not being picky. We can see it very much in just in a sitting practice when meditation comes along. You know, the bell, Ruben kindly strikes the bells for us to begin the sit, and we sit there. Okay, here we go. I'm in. All right, let's go. And we might like follow our breath, count some breaths, you know, maybe just to relax the shoulders a bit more, you know, and then what happens? Okay, for many of us, little voice pops up. Me. Did you forget about me? Here's me coming along. And me is not so interested in sitting on a wooden platform in an empty room with a bunch of people they don't know, with no, you know, with nothing to do. That's usually me isn't so captivated by that. Me would rather watch a movie. Me would rather scroll the phone. Me would rather be getting on with some, you know, whatever those tasks may be, right? So what happens with that me, I sense? Key shift in Zen, in meditation sitting. That sense of me, I, that thinking about things that comes up. What needs to be learned and practiced in meditation is to be able to separate or detach or transcend, or whatever word that we want to put there, from adding to the thought stream of pursuing after thinking. And that's difficult for most people who are beginning. Hey, it's difficult for most people, period, right? It's like that thinking mind that comes in, which is involved in being picky. It's like, I'm not feeling it right now. I'm tired, or I'm cranky, or whatever starts to come up in the mind, that pickiness can come in so very easily. Because naturally, a human being is picky. We have preferences. Humans have preferences. Buddhas don't. And we're on the realization curve. Human being to Buddha, and back again. Right? But human beings are immersed often in preferences. So we have a hard time sitting. You know, and we're thinking about this and that. To become developed, to practice Zazen and sitting meditation, though, we have helpful method. If we disrupt thinking mind and become immersed in sitting, breathing, and awaring the environment. And now we have the sound of the rain. You sit and become immersed as the sound of the rain. After all, that's what's real. That's realization. There's a realization of rain. Is that enough? Can you sit and listen to the rain for 30 minutes? Can we sit and listen to the rain or to silence or sound with the same inquiring attention for 30 minutes? Or for however long. Right? But for most of us, we need to practice that. There's the me, I sense of self of thinking about this and that can be interrupted with concentration practice, with koan, with different approaches. But somehow or other, the shift has to be made where we sit, thoughts arise, thoughts occur. But thoughts are treated as no more consequential than the sound of the raindrops. Now, me, I likes to compete and say, no, no, believe me, I am consequential. You left the oven on, right? Or me, this is important. Listen to me. You've got to think about this relationship you're in and what you're going to do when you get home. Now, me and, you know, so some of the surface kind of banal thinking about nothing in particular might be easy to let go of, but often there are deeper comments on reality which are harder to let go and disentangle. But the great way is knows no difficulty if only you dislike picking and choosing. If only you dislike being, if you can let go of preference and pickiness. So in sitting practice, that letting go of preference extends to the full spectrum of reality which is being experienced. That means allowing sound, silence, sight, thought, feeling, perception, and all of this content to be exactly as it is without the attendant value system we bring to it. And that can be realized, that is realized over time and practiced over time, but it's actually timeless. The way is timeless. So it can also be accessed spontaneously and immediately. Why not? It goes on. Just don't be dead set against or set on anything. Well, can we bring that to the other activity of our day? You know, so we come down and we have our sit-in and then we go down to breakfast. We might not like what's for breakfast. I mean, we're very fortunate with Tim, who's our Tenzo, because we usually like what's for breakfast. You know, actually, I could be like, that's not a good example. Everyone likes breakfast. Okay, work practice. Okay, that's something, right? It's like, what, they want me to go out into the woods with these loppers? Like, what's going? Like, and just trail down there and follow this guy? And okay, what am I? Right? So, as we get it, and then washing up. You know, it's like doing dishes. Or whatever the activity it is. There's a lot going on there in terms of activating the kind of preferential picking mind and our narrative around it. And this is also going on even when there's no active. How do we regard other people and the things in our life and the narrative and the preference and the picking and choosing around that? You see that, wow, as a human being, I'm lost in picking and choosing and categorizing and weighing and judging. Right? Now, but don't misconstrue that this is a practice which is abandon all preference. Right? It's like, I don't care if it's oatmeal every day. Breakfast is awesome. Put me out in the woods. I'll be there for, you know, I'll sleep out here with my loppers. It's not about reaching a place where there is no preference functioning anymore. But usually when we come into practice, we're skewed hard into the human condition experience of reality. That was the Buddha's motivation to practice, because when you're hard skewed into the human condition, there's a lot of that tends to be suffering and frustration. The fact of dukkha, as the Buddha identified it, right? It's like dissatisfactoriness. You begin a practice of meditation and spiritual inquiry, you start to let go, to realize and to let go, or at least have the choice to let go some of that suffering and dukkha and that preference. Begin to wake up and aware and see that as human beings, we create our own prison and our own suffering a lot of the time. It turns out that a lot of frustration, difficulty, and suffering is man-made and not particularly necessary. And through practice and realization, we learn to pass out the difference. What is unavoidable? well, old age, sickness, and death, as again the Buddha flagged, right? So there is suffering and there is pain in life that seems to come along with the experience of appearing as a form, right? That's the cost of experience. But within that, there is a way where we can better align with reality as it is and let go of a lot of extra difficulty which we've conditioned and created in our mind. Right? All of us are hopelessly conditioned as human beings by our experiences, by our parents, by society, by our culture, by conditioning is just always happening. In Zen and in meditation, you come to know, not intellectually apprehend, not know in that way, to know in your heart and bones what is unconditioned. Right? So we can be conditioned, but we're also unconditioned. We're human beings subject to the human condition, but we're also Buddhas and realized. What is that unconditioned way? Concerning the way, there is no difficulty if only you dislike being picky. Don't be dead set against or for anything. And then when you are like this, the way is obvious. Once you stop liking and disliking, it will enlighten itself. The way will enlighten itself. So this shift here is in learning in our practice of, you know, you need kind of courage and trust in Dharma practice and Zen practice to just say, you know what, I'm going to dive in the middle of it and see what happens. If you're on the, you know, kind of exploring the perimeter and looking in, that's fine. Walk around the fence, the perimeter, you know, have a look in and see whether you want to go for it or not. That's fine. That's fine when you come for a beginner's weekend, right? You're kind of checking it out. But at some point in Zen practice and in Dharma practice, you have to leap the fence, scramble over, and then explore. Explore. There are guides. There are people in the living and dead, old teachers and teachers who are alive now, who have gone ahead on that exploration and can help explain something of the likely territory you will encounter, but it'll be uniquely different for everybody. Right? But through this, if you aware this way that we catch ourselves with constant picking and choosing, preference, and you practice non-preference and allowing, a good, safe introduction to that is the meditation hall. Right, you can let go of picking and choosing in the meditation hall. It's not going to be, right? It's not going to be like a problem. You don't lose anything in sitting. Anything you can lose in meditation, anything that you can lose when you're sitting or forget, that's a positive. Let it go. Let the preferences go. Feel, experience, allow, sit. Even to do that for a short period of time is a powerful salve and medicine for an agitated body mind that is living in a world of constant adjustment and chaos. Right? Well, that's what I'm imagining it's like out there. It's like about in here too, actually. Wherever there's people, that will occur. So we're not escaping the conditioning, but rather aware it and see where you have space, freedom, and choice. Where you can let your preferences go and just be still, sit, allow, go into the next activity, accepting, seeing it as it is. Then, as it says here, it will enlighten itself. That sounds wonderful, but it could sound a little, you know, a little abstract. But you find that when you become present and aware, what to do in any activity becomes very obvious. As you match the activity and the environment that you're inhabiting and moving forward, what to do and how to do it becomes much more straightforward when present and engaged. You just begin that much more to align and to flow with life as it is. Life moves through you, and you are the expression of life that's moving through you. That is much more to enter the way. But if we're stood one step behind, looking at every activity or what's coming next, mistrusting it, judging it, analysis paralysis, not sure which choice to make, then we fall out of alignment with life, which is constantly moving and unfolding. The way is not difficult. It excludes picking and choosing. Once you give up like and dislike, it will enlighten itself. There's just four lines. There's about four pages of this stuff, but I'll pause at this point. I'm happy to open it up for questions and comment. Anything that you'd like to ask about what I've raised up?